At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Do you want to give a quick introduction to yourself? What you're doing? Where you're running? What's new and exciting in the world of politics, American politics?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I want to give a big shout out to all your viewers, but especially if you're in Texas, thank you so much for tuning in. I think you're about to hear some really interesting stuff of what's going on in Texas. We're under siege here, right, in Texas, and especially if you're from Austin or the surrounding Austin areas, I want to give a huge shout out to you guys. I am here in Austin, Texas. I'm running for U.S. Congress in Texas's brand new 37th district. So
nice.
Austin, Texas got a brand new district. This is one of the two new districts that Texas got out of the 2020 census. So out of all the 50 states, Texas is the only state that got two new districts, and one of them landed right in Austin, Texas. The cool thing is you never think about Texas when you think about, blue-leaning districts or left-leaning districts.
No.
But this district is solid left-leaning. So it's a huge opportunity, basically, to pick up a Democrat, believe it or not, a left-leaning person, a left person from Texas and put them into the U.S. Congress, which is unheard of given, you know, everything you hear out of Texas is basically like you're living in a parallel time zone, right?
Yeah.
Literally anything that can go wrong can go wrong. But I ran in 2020 and we got the highest voter turnout in the history of our district. And get this, in Williamson County, all of which was in my district where I ran, it was number one in voter turnout in all of Texas, number one among the top 25 most populated counties. So we won the nomination. There were a dozen people running, 6 on the ballot. I had never ran for office before. I don't know if you know, I'm just an average computer engineer that works in the tech industry. I ran for office, and of course, no one thought I could win the nomination. But we ended up winning the nomination through a runoff election, because in Texas, you have to get more than 50% of the vote to win the Democratic nomination. And we ended up getting such huge turnout. And now people are like, well, why is that a big deal? Because the problem is Texas is so gerrymandered, and it was already the most difficult state to vote in. But what happened is basically, in 2021, they did redistricting. We got two new districts, and they gerrymandered the districts even further. So you're like, well, how do you get a left-leaning district, a Democratic district, when you've been gerrymandered further? Well, the reason that is they took all the districts. So Austin was sliced like a pizza into 6 pieces, and 5 of them were represented by like right-wing, GOP, ultra-extreme folks. And so they were kind of at the beginning of the decade, 2010, they were winning by, 20, 30 points, right? That's how they draw the districts. But at the end of the decade, close to 2020, they were only winning by single digits. So in order to shore them up and give them huge, runways for the next decade, because the GOP is extremely strategic and they're thinking, decades ahead, they made their districts even redder. And in order to do that, they had to create what's called a sink district, where they pack in all the Dems. And that is where I'm running in 2022.
Oh, so it's kind of like it's a complete fluke that ended up the way it did. But you're just in that like little concentrated area. That's like, okay, so first off, that's kind of scary considering like how much you hear about gerrymandering, especially in like deep conservative states. What is the chances of you being successful in that? Because you're saying that it's like it's a left leaning district, but how left are we talking? Because like the only place in Texas I ever think of as being left is what, like Austin is supposed to be like a little progressive, but otherwise like the rest of the state is pretty solid conservative territory.
Yep. So this is solid left leaning, meaning whoever wins the Democratic nomination in this race will go to Congress. There's no way around it. They've packed all the Dems into this district. This is Austin, Texas. You know, this is where I live. And it's a matter of which left person, which Democrat are you going to send to Congress? That's all it's all about.
Absolutely. What are you up against in terms of like opponents, in terms of obstacles, fundraising? Is this like a grassroots campaign?
Yeah, this is, my campaign is fully grassroots, right? Like I said, I don't have big political background, have huge, you know, PACs or organizations supporting me. But here's the interesting part. We have thousands and thousands of individual contributors that have contributed $5, $10. And so, yes, I'm up against, you know, folks that have $6 million in their war chest. But bottom line is, you know, we've overcome more in the past. And the way we did that is by going door to door, by taking your message directly to the voters. So when people think of Texas and they think of, you know, specifically Texas, they're like, that place is, you know, gone. There's nothing we can do about that. Mm-hmm. But what they don't realize is that Texas's population is extremely young, and we can actually get out the vote. If we can get out the vote among people that really want to see change, you can win in Texas. And the way you do that is you have to take the message right to the doors of people, because as you know, a lot of young people, they're not paying attention to what's on cable news. They don't even know that in Texas, basically reproductive rights are banned. Voting rights have been even more restricted, if you can think of that.
I was going to get to that, but I was like, they watch streamers instead, right? And they all speak these weird languages, like say poggers and other stuff like that. It's just like, it's a wild world out there, I tell you.
I hope they're listening to you, streamers, and because, you know, hopefully you're letting them know that the only way, by the way, Texas is so gerrymandered, by the way, there's not a single race, not at the state level, state rep level, not at the state Senate level, not at the U.S. congressional level, that is competitive. The only way to take back Texas is to win statewide. So a lot of people are like, oh, Texas is gerrymandered. Well, there's no gerrymandering statewide. So if you wanted to win and you wanted to take back Texas, you could, but you have to go to every single Democrat and tell them to come out and vote. So here's the interesting thing. In 2018, and I don't know if your viewers, you know, agree or disagree or don't like or like Beto O'Rourke, but Beto O'Rourke is running for governor, and we have the governor's race at the top of the ticket in 2022, right? And in 2018, when he ran against Ted Cruz, we calculated in my, you know, campaign that there were at least 100,000, like somewhere around 100,000 votes in Austin, Texas, of Democrats that are registered to vote. We're not talking about voter registration issues. We have over 95% voter registration. In fact, in Travis County, I think it's even higher than that. Mm-hmm. So if you can get, he was only short 215,000 votes, okay? Imagine if the bluest parts of Texas, you know, El Paso, Texas, San Antonio, Texas, parts of Dallas-Fort Worth, parts of Houston, and of course, if you got the 100,000 votes from Austin, Texas, you can flip a statewide race, whether that's the governor's race or the lieutenant governor's race or the AG's race. You all of a sudden have all this control over Texas policy, and you don't see crazy things like $10,000 bounty, you know, if you try to help someone going to see a doctor. That's where we are right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Speaking about the abortion bill. Okay. So to the first part of your, I guess, question, Beto O'Rourke, I would have liked to see him defeat Ted Cruz, because obviously Ted Cruz is pure evil. And I apologize, by the way, he's Canadian. I'm sorry for sending him your way. But, you know, but outside of that, I don't really appreciate how he's consistently like, why is he running for the president? Why is he doing this? Right. But obviously, I would rather have him in power than Ted. I wanted to talk to you then, because that's obviously, it sounds like it's got to be a core issue when it comes to the abortion bill that just got passed in Texas. Are you approaching this from the perspective that you're going to try and get it repealed? Are you going to try and get something codified at a state level that can protect people's reproductive rights?
So there's only a couple of ways to do this, by the way. One is, if you switch out the governor, all of a sudden you can start having big say over legislative directions. So if you don't win the governor's race, if you don't win the governor's race or the lieutenant governor's race or the AG's race, we're stuck with this for the next 4 years. That is the only way at the state level you can do it. Unless the Supreme Court does something and it looks like they're going the other way around right now, nothing can happen, right? Unless Congress codifies it and passes something, which they technically could, you know, they've got a very slim Democratic majority, but unless they do it, no, we are doomed here in Texas. So this is why I know that people will come out and say every single election is the most important election of your life. Well, 2022 is the most important election for Texas, because if we have the same Governor Abbott for the next 4 years, we're stuck with the status quo. And the status quo is no reproductive health care, very, very restrictive voting laws. So, for example, you know, in Texas, a lot of people have, you know, grandparents or maybe like immigrant parents or whatever, and they're trying to help them fill out their ballots, right? And so we, for example, earlier this year, we had these 10 constitutional amendments. And I'm telling you, I had to go study them in order to be able to vote the right way, whether I support the amendment or not, right? Mm-hmm. And bottom line is, if you help anybody, like if you go to your next door neighbor and say, hey, do you need any help, you know, going to the place to go vote, right? The polling location, you have to sign away and say, I did not offer them help. Like they requested me to help. Like you have to be, or you'll be held accountable. You have to sign on the dotted line. You have to give your name and address, blah, blah, blah. This is a way to basically intimidate people from helping somebody else to vote. If you take more than three people that are your neighbors, if you take somebody who's unrelated to you, like doesn't live in the same house as you, and you just drive them to the polling location, same deal. You have to fill out a form. Like, these are really, really extreme things that they've put in, the GOP has put in a way to intimidate and stop people from voting. The other thing that people don't realize is that a lot of people who do hourly work, let's say you're a nurse, right? And you work you work two shifts back to back, and you're not even allowed to take time off. Like, you guys heard right now, right? There are these 100, Latino, Hispanic workers in California that make these cakes, right, for Baskin Robbins and all these other places like Walmart. And they're basically, this lady was going on and she was like, my shift starts at 5 a.m. and it ends at 1:30. At 1:25, they come and tell me you have to stay for the second shift. So this also happens to healthcare workers, anybody who works hourly. So what one of the counties here did, Harris County, is they said during the pandemic, they were like, let's do 24-hour voting. Anyone can come in and vote. Let's make it really easy for these people. And of course, what did the Texas GOP do? They outlawed it. Yeah, they put in writing that you cannot do that. So they don't want to cut you any kind of slack, give you any kind of opportunity to actually be able to come out and vote. And a lot of people are like, anybody who wants to vote in this country can vote no matter what. It's really easy. If you want to vote, you're going to find time to vote. When you have little children, when you're working two shifts, you know, doubles one after the other, when you're on your feet all day long, and then you go to the polling location and you have to stand there for 6 hours, and you think this is crazy? I'm telling you, I ran in 2020 in Temple, Texas, for an entire city of over 60,000 people. They had four machines. Four.
That's four, like, machines. They had lines out for seven hours. See, like, and like, that's, you should not have to spend your entire day waiting in line just to do a democracy. Like, that just sounds absolutely absurd to me. And I can't relate to it, because, like, in Canada, I wait 5 minutes in a polling station to get in and out, you know? So, and when someone's like, yeah, people deliver food because you have to eat because you're there for, like, 7 hours, I'm like, wow. And especially because it's, like, it's unpaid too, right? So for someone to spend 7 hours of their day, that's a lot of money, especially if you're not making more than like minimum wage.
It's completely ridiculous. My supporters, you know, in Killeen and Temple, they sent me photographs where there were lines just like going on for like half a mile long. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
And in some of these districts, they had lower than 40% turnout because they basically limit the number of machines. These are the kind of tricks that they play in order to stop people from voting, which is just unheard of.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask too, beyond those, is there going to be a push for things like, say, $15 minimum wage? I know debt forgiveness can't come from that level, but other like typical progressive, talking points that aren't really being addressed by the Democrats at large right now. I feel like there's like a ton of broken promises coming from the Biden administration. So are you going to try and tackle some of those from like your level, from a more local level?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm running for U.S. Congress. This is a federal, you know, office. I would have some say over student loans, and I have an opinion on student loans and why basically this is a huge challenge for the United States. But let's go back to your $15 an hour, sure, first of all, because one of the things that I'm running on, and it's been very core to my platform, is focus on worker rights, right? Being able to, it's not just about money, by the way, like these people are being abused at a point which doesn't even make sense, where they're not allowed to take time off to go get chemotherapy. Like, that's how ridiculous their employers have gotten. So in Austin, Texas, most of the fast food places, the retail places, are already paying $15. That is literally the minimum, even though the minimum wage is the federal minimum wage. It's $7.25 in Texas, which is ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. But in most places in Austin, Texas, they're already paying $15, if not $18. And you know, you'll see $17, $18 also advertised here and there. So that's not the challenge. The challenge is Austin has now become the most expensive place to live outside of the big California big cities. So it is the 11th largest city now, right now, in all of the United States. And the median home price of in Austin about 5 or 6 years ago used to be $250,000, right? Median home price. Right now, the median home price in Austin is over $527,000. So this used to be a really affordable place. And the reason that is we have all these tech companies, Google, Apple, Tesla, that have moved in over the last 5 years. But for every single software engineer that has a 100,000, six-figure job, right? They're making over $100,000. They're making 100, 200, 250, et cetera. There are three people. There are three people that make under $70,000, under $60,000. So when you make that kind of money in Austin, Texas, you can never afford a home here. You'll never afford mortgage. You can't even own your own apartment. You can't even like afford to pay rent for your own apartment. The going joke here is that right now you have six people sharing three-bedroom homes in Austin, Texas. So you're well into your 30s and you're still sharing a bedroom. We're not talking about sharing an apartment. We're talking about sharing a bedroom with a roommate, and you don't know when you will be able to have a family. So that's one of the biggest problems we're seeing in Austin, Texas. The second thing in Texas is that the real estate tax here is really high. So people are like, oh, in Texas, you don't have income taxes. Okay, great. But we have real estate taxes. So if you want to start a family and buy a home, so you pay close to 3% in real estate taxes on the value of your home. But here's the kicker. The kicker is that keeps going up year after year after year. So meaning, let's say, for example, you bought a home at $500,000. Next year, your home is valued at $550,000. Now you pay 3% on that $550,000, not $500,000 anymore. So it continually goes up. So think about it. If you're a social worker and you've never made more than $60,000, $70,000 in your entire life, let's say you're 65 years old, now you're retired, or you're a teacher, or you work in a nonprofit, right? So you bought a tiny three-bedroom home with one-car garage in Austin, Texas. You probably bought it for $70,000 like 35 years ago. You paid it off. Now that home is worth $800,000 in central Austin, close to $1 million. Now you have to pay 3% in real estate taxes on fixed Social Security. You can barely afford food. And you know, some people are sacrificing things like, you know, prescription drugs because you have to pay for that. It's called Part D. So you could have worked your entire life. You could have, be living on Social Security, but you can't afford the home that you purchased. You're literally being forced to leave Austin, Texas, because you can't even afford the taxes on a home that you fully paid off. So that's what we're struggling with here in terms of the $15 an hour, which you brought up. The second thing you brought up was student loans. I would love to address that if you would let me.
Absolutely. Yeah, please.
Okay, thanks. So here's the reason why student loans should be forgiven. Student loans were originally set up.
I'm so happy you started with that.
Go ahead.
I'm so happy you started with that. I thought it was going to be like, so here's why we should never forgive student loans. I'm like, oh no.
So, here we go. I know that everyone talks about forgiving student loans, right? But forgiving student loans is not going to be enough. But here's why they should be forgiven. If someone says to you, oh, you took the loan, you should pay for it, right? Here's the reason why. It was set up as a scam because over the past four to five decades, the cost of education, college education, has shot up 3,000%. Now ask yourself this. Are university professors all of a sudden getting a 3,000% bump in their salaries? If you go, by the way, University of Texas at Austin, which is one of the premier universities of, across Texas, you can go look up every single salary for every single professor. There are tenured professors that are being paid under $100,000 with PhD and have been teaching for decades here in Austin, Texas, right? So they're not making, they didn't get a 3,000% increase. So what are they doing? Are they bulldozing the entire university and rebuilding it every year? Like, what exactly is this money going for? The University of Texas at Austin has a close to a $40 billion endowment. And they don't touch that endowment because they're basically gouging young people, teenagers, students, because they can get student loans. And the whole student loan system was set up as a scam to basically put you in indentured servitude for the rest of your life to be in debt till the day you die. And I don't know if you know this, but in the United States, right, they talk about death and taxes. Mm-hmm. There are two areas where you can never file bankruptcy. One is if you owe child support, they can garnish your wages and you can never file bankruptcy. Two is if you owe taxes, they can garnish your wages and it never goes away. You can never file bankruptcy. And guess what the third one is? It's student loans. Student loans, they can garnish your wages and you can never file bankruptcy. So it was set up as a scam and that is the reason it should be removed, because the point is this: education should cost nothing. And Open University at MIT has already shown this. They offer many, many classes completely free. You know, Khan Academy has shown this. Technology should be basically driving the cost of education down to nothing. And not to mention there are, countries around the world that are not just investing in their young people billions and billions of dollars, but they're making education completely at zero cost to their kids. And so there's no reason why we should be able to do that. That's number one. But number two is this. A lot of people are like, okay, fine. Let's say you forgive student loans. What happens to the next generation? And that's one of the things that I'm really focused on, is that we have to make sure that we lower the cost of education to nothing. Because if you have an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old in your home that wants to go to college, or even wants to go to trade school, or just wants to get Microsoft certification of some sort, right? It costs money. It costs tens of thousands of dollars. And if you want to go to medical school, really expensive. Law school, even more expensive. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, nobody wants to be a primary care physician in the United States, because primary care physicians only get paid maybe $110,000 or $120,000. And that's after, going to school for years and years and years.
$500,000 worth of student debt too. Like, how are you supposed to pay that off? It's unbelievable.
So a lot of people don't know that one of the reasons that we have the worst healthcare system in the world is because we have a major lack of primary care physicians. We have over 90,000 physicians in the United States practicing right now that were trained and educated in other countries. So what the United States is basically saying is, look, we're going to load you up with huge, enormous mortgage size loans if you want to go to med school. And so what are people doing? They're not going to med school. And if they go to med school, they're specializing, because they're saying, you know what? If I want to pay off a $200,000, $300,000 loan, I better go be a heart surgeon, because that's the only way I'm going to be able to pay it off. So I'm not going to be a primary care physician. So it's cheaper to go get a computer science degree and go out to the Bay Area and make $250,000 straight out of school than go to be a primary care physician and only make $110,000 or $20,000. You see what I'm trying to say? Yeah. So we are shooting ourselves in the foot as we talk about it with respect to education. And like I said, the reason the student loan should be forgiven is it was set up as a scam and it absolutely needs to be addressed. But the last thing I want to end with is this. There's no reason why it has to be done at the expense of the taxpayer. the United States government, Congress, can pass laws and they don't have to pay this back. Because if you go look at the majority of people who have student loans, you know what they're doing? They have, let's say they took a $30,000 loan, right? They've paid off that $30,000. They've even paid off much of the interest. And they still have another $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 left. That's ridiculous. The United States government, the Congress should just say, enough is enough. You've taken your principal, you've taken interest. We're not going to pay it back. They're not obligated to pay it back, by the way. And this would do literally nothing because they've gouged all these students. The universities have already taken the money. The people who own these loans are big, huge Wall Street banks, which we've bailed out once, you know, during the 2008 crisis. And we should just say, you've taken all the money. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. the other thing I want to say about that is, how do you resurrect that after the fact that Joe Biden has pretty much said that it's like he's done with it. He's not going to do it.
You know, one of the problems that we have in Congress is that just going to Congress and running on a platform is not enough. We need people in Congress that are going to be actively strategizing. How do you get a bill passed in Congress? How do you actually get your own caucus, right? We saw this with the Build Back Better bill, right? We had everybody on Twitter saying, hold the line, hold the line. And then what happened? The Build Back Better bill was stripped down from $3.5 trillion all the way to $1.75. And by the way, they took out my favorite thing in there, which was tuition-free two-year community college. Mm-hmm. Tuition-free two-year community college. They took that out, right? And they took out all the best part of it. They stripped it down to nothing. They told people who have been in this country, DACA recipients, they've been in here for a decade. They've been promising them for actually two decades that they were going to give them a path to citizenship. Out. Everything's out of that, right? But who's actually in Congress saying, hey, how do we get the caucus to come together? Who's going across the aisle? And instead of just hurling insults at each other, how are we organizing inside Congress? We need someone in there with data and facts. And we need, by the way, Congress gets to send frank mail to all of their constituents for free. They get a budget to be able to write a letter to all their constituents and explain these things to them. There's a huge opportunity here for every single Democrat in Congress. It doesn't matter who you are, to write a letter and explain what is happening with student loans and why this is bad for our country, why it is killing the innovation in the United States. Whereas you have countries right now like China. I know it sounds like a trident, you know, a tired kind of excuse. But even the Chinese government is now investing in their students to make sure they're well-rounded. They realize just having, you know, lab rats that know how to do mathematics and physics and engineering is not enough. You need well-rounded people who have good communication skills, who have arts and science is a mix of them. You need the arts, that you need well-spoken people. They're investing in well-rounded people, and they're going to have an entire generation of kids that are going to have abilities that our kids are not going to have in the United States because we're not investing in them and we don't care. And in fact, we're putting barriers in front of them. So how do you do it in Congress? You need to have somebody who's caucus building and making it a priority for the United States, for the American people, versus just appealing to donors. The problem with donors is this. Look, in our country, we have what's called a donor class. And this donor class is not you who's giving $5 or $10 or $50, right? Even people like I have, you know, the one or two few people that you can count on one hand that maxed out on my campaign, right? Let's say, for example, $2,900. Those are not donor class. Just because you're upper middle class and you decided, hey, this candidate would be great to have an engineer in Congress, I'm going to give him $2,900. That doesn't make you donor class. I want your viewers to understand, donor class are people who are investing millions, in some cases, $10 million. If your income, let's say, for example, annual income is $5 million, what is $100,000 to you? It's nothing. You can literally give $2,900 to everybody. You can give to the political parties. You can write a check for $100,000. We have people right here in Texas, business people, who are writing over $1 million checks to GOP candidates right here in Texas, right? So I'm talking about the donor class. And those are the people calling these, they have, you know, the direct cell phone numbers of Congress. And they're calling them up and saying, I want you to do this, I want you to do that. They're not listening to their constituents. But it's a two-way street. Congress has an when you are an elected person in Congress, you have a lot of ability to communicate with your constituents. Number one, they're listening to you. Number two, you get free money to communicate to them. So how many Congress people have communicated directly to you? Ask yourself, have you gotten a letter in the mail from your Democratic U.S. Congressperson that represents you that talks about the fact that we are overpaying for healthcare by $2 trillion annually? And if we had single-payer healthcare, Medicare for All, for example, that would cut the cost of your care and it would not cost you anything. It would actually put money back in your pocket. You'd get a tax cut. Have you ever gotten a letter from a Democratic congressperson? Let's forget about the GOP, right? Have you ever gotten a letter that explains to you why student loan debt was set up as a scam? Right? Think about it that way. So
I haven't heard of an American having that done to them. That would be amazing. I didn't even know that feature existed until you told me right now. Yes. That's actually the first time I've ever heard of that.
It's called franked mail. Look it up. They get an entire budget for it.
That's wild. Can I quickly just interject there, though, because you were just talking about donor class and you were also talking about Build Back Better. I'm very curious, how exactly do you get something like this? Because, I mean, I think we're running out of time for Build Back Better to be passed before 2022. And the biggest obstacles are the same ones that have been since the start of this, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. So how exactly are you going to be able to defeat maybe the two people who are going to be the holdouts for passing necessary and significant legislation and like the very kind you're talking about?
That's a great question. So unfortunately, that boat has sailed a little bit. But let me tell you this. When they had the infrastructure bill, the two people that were most invested in the infrastructure bill were Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin. So I don't know if you remember the video with President Biden on the White House lawn and the 8 or 9 GOP senators. And then you had Senator Sinema and you had Senator Manchin standing on two sides because they were so invested in this bill, this infrastructure bill. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that you exert leverage in Congress, especially if you're trying to get something passed, because it's so difficult to get something passed, you can also ask to take something out before you sign for it. You can negotiate, hey, I will sign on this bill if you take this out and if you allow me to put this in Build Back Better, which is a leverage that, by the way, the Democrats in Congress had. Remember, hold the line, the hold the line hashtag was all over Twitter, right? Yeah,
that was exciting.
That was their opportunity. But you have to be willing. You have to be willing to give up things and take things out. And what happened there is instead of negotiating things that the infrastructure bill, just so you guys know, was fully negotiated and written in the Senate. The people in the House, Democrats in the House, had no say. They did not strike a single line. They did not put anything in there. They didn't take anything out of there. That was the time before that passed to put pressure and take it out. Now, of course, President Biden also has a lot of say. He has the bully pulpit, right? But that would have been the time to actually negotiate Build Back Better. So how does that work? So the Democrats passed Build Back Better later, right? In the House, right?
In the House.
But they initially said what? We're not gonna pass Build Back Better. We're not gonna pass the infrastructure bill without Build Back Better. So they held that infrastructure bill up for months. So what was the outcome of that? So you either hold it up for months because you're going to get something, right? Or you don't hold it up for months and you let it go and you say, look, here's the best we can do. And you go on. So they got neither, right? My point is we need leadership in Congress that's going to hold them accountable. If you don't think that Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin didn't have a stake in that infrastructure bill, you're not paying attention. Right. Yeah. So there are ways to bring them over. There are things that they need in order to be elected. There are things that are important to them. And if you want to do good things for the American people, you're going to have to build coalitions. Right. And I'm not in Congress, so maybe it's impossible to bring GOP House members. But guess what? This year was a huge opportunity because it was redistricting. Right. Mm-hmm. So Democrats in certain states have the ability to redistrict out sitting Republican or GOP House members. The same kind of they had the same kind of power over Democratic sitting House members. So if you had leadership in Congress that really wanted to get things passed, they could have used those levers. They could have used those levers. And Speaker Pelosi uses fundraising levers all the time. It is possible to use levers, but yes, you have to build a coalition, you have to hold your ground, and you have to be willing to negotiate and take things out of the bill as well as wanting to pass things. If you want to pass things, you have to be willing to take things out of the bill. And those are areas where Congress could have taken leadership and done something.
Yeah. What about holding something else hostage instead of just the infrastructure bill? Like, what are the bills that always get passed in the United States that are agreed upon by both sides? Like increasing, say, the military budget or the Pentagon budget. So $725 billion this year. And there's like that one is passed almost universally by both sides. It's the first time everyone gets along. Is there any efficacy in perhaps banding together with, say, Justice Democrats or more progressive wings of the Democratic Party to say, maybe this is something that we don't want to just cash a check on, and we think we should do some more social spending as a deal for this?
I love that you brought that up, by the way. This is a really interesting point. A lot of people think that if you can go to the extreme left members of our Congress and try to build a caucus, that will be sufficient. Now, we saw that is not sufficient because on the infrastructure bill, there were six extreme left Democrats that decided not to vote for that. Remember that? They did not vote for the infrastructure bill, but it passed anyway because they had 13 GOP House members that voted for it.
Yeah.
The way to get this done is we have this illusion that the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the CPC is what they're known as, is one team, and they believe in the same things. And that's what we kept hearing. So originally, if you went to the CPC, you would see they had 96 members, right? So you think that these people are all together and they could actually get things passed. But the bottom line is this, that there are a lot of people that basically join the CPC to be able to call themselves what's called, quote unquote, progressive, right? So they sell themselves to their constituents as, I'm a progressive candidate because I'm part of the CPC, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is when it actually goes to vote, these members always vote with whatever the way everybody else votes. If you go look at every Democratic vote, if you look at the quote unquote moderates or conservative Democrats, the CPC members are voting the same way. So how can you be part of the CPC and also vote with the most conservative Democrats? That people like Gothamaya, for example, right? So what we saw is that the core members of the CPC voted with people like Representative Gothamaya, who was vilified because he's a conservative Democrat. The essential thing is here that we need to build a caucus that's much bigger than just six people in Congress. And it needs to be truly people who are focused on getting specific legislation through. So they can focus on things like single-payer healthcare, Medicare for all, which is what I would do if I was in Congress. I would like to take leadership on that, build a caucus around that, and then strategically work on how do we get that passed? How do we lobby the president? How do we actually bring members of the GOP over? Because believe it or not, there are lots of people on the other side that understand that we were overpaying for healthcare by $2 trillion. We're paying close to $4 trillion. And every single study out there, even the ones that are done by conservative think tanks, say that we should not be paying a single penny over $2 trillion for healthcare in this country. So we're paying double the amount. You can get people over if you negotiate with them, collaborate with them. Now, how easy is it? It's not easy. It's never going to be easy to get good things done for the American people because we're up against the donor class. We're up against people who sit on Wall Street boards, right, of major companies, and they're comfortable.
Insurance companies.
If they get sick, they can be flown away to anywhere they want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like that ambitious thinking. I don't see the GOP legitimately being swayed to something that would go in direct contradiction of, say, the insurance companies and their lobbying groups when it comes to the United States. That's like one of the biggest obstacles. But hey, if you can get it done, I mean, someone has to. At some point.
But it's not just the GOP. The point I really was making is that even within the CPC, those 96 members, even they're not together when it comes to legislation like single-payer healthcare. Co-sponsoring is not enough. Many of them co-sponsor bills, but when it actually comes down to it, they're not actually lobbying. They're not forcing a way to get that bill passed, right? They're not advocating for it internally. That's the point, really, that I was trying to make.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I wanted to ask you something a little different, because you worked, or either you worked or you do work in the tech industry as an engineer.
Yeah, so I started my career out as a design and development engineer, and over the years, I've bought many, many different successful products to market. That's been my background. So yeah, go ahead. What's your question?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about, you were bringing up tech giants earlier, and you were talking about you know, technology companies like Amazon, for example, and you know, there's other monstrous ones, Alphabet, Facebook, and then how they've all arrived in Texas now. There's a lot of discussion around has their control become too large, because we now kind of depend on a lot of these monstrously huge corporations for all of our communication online, right? I'm hearing from the right that they kind of want to keep everything as like a free speech universality. And then how do we control them? From the far left, people are talking about, well, we need to nationalize like these companies to try and bring them under control. I don't know what your approach or personal ideas are surrounding that, so I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, so there's two aspects to it. One is, when we talk about nationalizing, one of the aspects of nationalizing we should focus on is being able to communicate freely, right? So for internet, basically, internet, 5G, one of the challenges that happen is we talked about there's I think close to $60 billion in the infrastructure bill for internet services, right? So I'm going to address your nationalization question first, and then I'll go back and talk about other tech companies and whether they should be broken up or not. The reason I want to bring up the internet part is that I live in Austin, Texas, and around Austin, Texas, there are all these small towns, right? During the pandemic, when all the kids were told to get on Zoom and take classes, we had people basically 30, 45 minutes out from Austin that live in small places like Hutto or Taylor, Texas, which are literally 50 minute drive from Austin, Texas, from the outskirts of Austin, Texas. All of a sudden, these kids, they found out they don't even have a computer at home, and the majority of them had no high-speed internet. So they had to take up these buses and wire them with internet to get them some sort of internet to be able to just go to class. That was number one. Now, the question that the American people should be asking is, why is that? Because the United States government actually gave technology companies, internet companies, billions and billions of dollars to go get internet to rural areas. And a lot of people, when they think about Texas, they don't realize how rural Texas, parts of Texas are. Texas is so big, certain countries could drive around in Texas. That's how big it is, right?
Yeah, it's massive.
It's massive. So we have lots of rural areas. So basically, the United States government gave money to lots of private companies, and they ate that money. Even in Austin, Texas, we have no choice in internet. We have AT&T and we have Spectrum. And AT&T gives you one kind of internet and Spectrum gives you another, right? That's right. One is cable and one is fiber. That's it. We barely have no type of competition. If you go anywhere else in the United States, you will find something very similar. There's no competition with respect to internet. So they've price fixed that. So the reason I bring this up is that there's an opportunity to take that and make internet something that's owned and decentralized by municipalities, right? This would not only create great union jobs, but it would also ensure that everybody actually has internet access. I don't know where the $60 billion is going to go. That's in the infrastructure bill. But after that $60 billion gets paid out to these companies, I just hope that these rural small cities and towns actually have internet, which I still am skeptical of, because this has been done before. So that's with respect to nationalization. Those are the kinds of things that I believe that we should focus on nationalization. Now, I want to go back to your original question about tech companies and breaking them down. One of the challenges you have to understand is companies like Amazon, majority of us only see sort of their interface, where we go in and we buy all their products off of Amazon, right? And I want to address that real quickly before I get to the rest of it. Amazon is known to look at a product that's selling well, duplicate it, put their Amazon brand on it, and then put that up on SEO. So when you search for something, you only see their brand and you never see the other company's brand. And they put hundreds and hundreds of companies, small mom and pop shops, out of business. That is bad. But that's not the biggest, baddest part of Amazon. Amazon has its tentacles in so many different areas, especially on the back end with respect to servers. So many different companies run their back end on Amazon AWS servers. Now, once you have Amazon across the entire spectrum, where they not only have all of the back end servers, but the front end, and they're taking over everything that you basically see and are doing, that's a bad thing. And we should break them down if that happens. The same thing with when they truly become a monopoly across multiple different areas of services. It absolutely has to be done because it's bad and it's definitely putting small businesses completely out. The reason that we should be worried about that is not because they're killing just small businesses, which is bad in itself. But when you have only one source for the most important things, that's also a national security issue, right? In terms of, you know, you look in the United States and you look at major farms, corporate farms, taking over all of the family farms. That jeopardizes our food supply to not have a decentralized food supply. That's something that we can fall back on. So that's the main reason that we should be focused on breaking these tech companies up with instead of saying, oh, we just want to break them up because we feel like they're getting too big. So there has to be some nuance here. And I think what's missing in our country, the biggest thing that's missing, is that you can't talk about any subject with any kind of nuance anymore. It's always you're either on this side or you're that side. And if you don't believe this, then you're done. And this is one of the biggest challenges with Congress, because we have people in Congress right now that have absolutely no idea about technology, right? So they're getting their advice on technology from lobbyists of major corporations, right? If you go look in Congress, all the people that are in Congress, just look at the Democratic U.S. House of Representatives, Democratic representatives. I don't think you'll find a single electrical and computer engineer in Congress right now that can actually have a substantive conversation with a tech vice president or a CEO and be able to talk at their level or at the depth of another engineer that's creating that technology. We just don't have that. They don't even have that kind of staff, you know, right now. So this is a huge problem for our Congress looking forward. And part of the reason that you see the United States so broken right now is because corporations have completely taken over, not just running the United States from a technology standpoint, but also from the United States government. That's the only people that are writing these bills, and they're writing it to their advantage.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone approach the issues of big tech from a national security issue. Perspective. But I really like that. That's interesting, because typically those aren't the kind of things that you talk about when people discuss national security, or at least even pouring resources into things of national security. That's like that. That is more interesting if they went after monstrously huge multinational corporations instead of monitoring citizens or stuff like that.
It's the same thing with Big Pharma, by the way. The fact that we let five different companies, dictate all our, medication in this country, that's also bad for us. It's the same thing with education. By the way, not investing in education in this country is the biggest national security issue. People go around saying, oh, not everybody needs to go to college. You need people at all levels. You need smart people. You need people who are able to work on the next generation of technology. And not doing that, by the way, the majority of investment in AI and machine learning, the money that's being invested is being now invested outside the United States. You can guess which country, but it's being invested outside the United States. And I know a lot of people, especially GOP folks, think that, oh, the way we're the greatest country in the world is because we have the biggest military. You know, we're spending, like you said, $750 billion annually, right? But what they don't realize is that that is not where our strength comes from. Our strength in this country, the reason the United States is number one in the world and everything, comes from the fact that we are creating products and services on a daily basis. People in the United States get up every morning, go to work, create products and services and value, and they create all the wealth in this country. The minute you dampen innovation, the minute you dampen entrepreneurship, which is happening right now, right? Because you can't go be an entrepreneur because you're scared you're not going to have healthcare and you can't afford $400 a month with a deductible of $7,400. That's a bronze package, by the way, in the marketplace. If you go to the marketplace and go sign up right now in Austin, Texas, right? And you say, I'm going to be an entrepreneur starting tomorrow. And you're a single person. Forget about the fact about having a family, a wife and children, right? You have to come up with $400 a month, every single month, for which you get nothing. You get nothing for that. And on top of that, if you want to get healthcare, you need to come up with another $7,000, $8,000 in deductibles. That is a ridiculous way to stop innovation in this country right now.
I think I have to agree with chat that there's no way you're actually an engineer because you're so well spoken. Like they were saying that as a joke, but I completely agree with you. I think we do need engineers, especially one who has experience working in a lot of these fields, to go to Congress because I don't want people being educated strictly by lobbying groups. And that's when you also see all these really weird takes from like, that's not how the internet works. Why are you saying this? I'm unfortunately getting a little close to the hour here, so I just wanted to ask if people are inspired by you and your message and everything you've been saying today, how can they get involved?
Yes, I would love that. Please go to my website, voteforDonna.com. That's vote, FORDONNA.com. Help us. If you know anybody in Austin, Texas, the way we get to Congress is votes. So if you know anybody in Austin, Texas, ask them to come out and vote for us. Ask them to come out and volunteer for us. Go door to door and just leave our message. All we need to do to win this election is get our message. It is not about, trying to win with the message. We already have a winning message, right? All we need to do is get our message to voters and we can win this. So, and if you have the ability to donate and you're a United States citizen or a resident of the United States, you can also donate $5, $10, or if you're super wealthy, you can donate some more. But every single dollar counts and we'll be maximizing every single dollar to reach voters. So that's how you can get involved. If you want to volunteer on our campaign, we'd love to have your help. If you're here in Austin, Texas, and want to go door to door and leave our information, because that's all we need to do. Believe it or not, if the minute I can get my data, my message in front of voters, I automatically am able to convince them to vote for us. So that is the biggest thing we need. And I just want to thank you so much for having me on your stream today. I really, really appreciate this opportunity. It means a lot. I also want to let your viewers know that I do an open forum, 9 p.m. Central Time, Twitter Spaces, every single Monday. If you want to come ask me questions directly, awesome. Join me. It's completely open. I open up the mic for everybody to come talk to me directly.
Oh, that's really cool. This is like, that's the first good use of Twitter Spaces that I've heard so far. Otherwise, it's all these weird things. I won't get into them because I don't want to spoil your night. But like, it's not been a good scene. So I'm glad to hear there's one at least. Oh, and just one quick question: can foreigners help? Can foreigners donate, or is that an American thing only?
No, you have to be either a United States citizen or a United States resident, like a green card holder, to be able to donate. So if you're not one of those two, you can't donate, but you can volunteer. You can retweet me. You can follow me on social media. You can post on your Facebook account. There are many, many ways to support. And you know what? You can go to your favorite Twitch streamer or your YouTuber and ask them to have me, because the most important thing is getting our message to voters and people around the United States. What I like to say is this: I'm bringing the economic case for the things that we on the left believe are the morally right thing to do.
That's a good pitch. And hey, to everyone here who's here from those big raids we had earlier, like the Vosh fans, the Chud Logic fans, the Pirate Vision fans, go tell them to have Donna on, and that way we can spread the message.
Please.
More. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It was an absolute pleasure, Donna. I'll hopefully talk to you soon, and I'll give you some retweets.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening.
Bye. That was awesome. I was not expecting to have so much clear, concise, and eloquent answers to a lot of harder questions. Sorry, I didn't get to the two questions that Kubi asked. I thought that she answered it at the very start, though, a little bit, when she was like talking about how she got into politics after being an engineer. But yeah, she is awesome. She's absolutely awesome. That's really cool. And like, honestly, very adult with how she approaches a lot of the topics. And I don't mean that in a, like, kids are like, I'm going to condescend to children or anything like that. I mean in that, like, it's true that nuance is kind of important when discussing issues. Like, what is going to be more politically effective? If someone is like, hey, by the way, we need to, like, destroy Amazon tomorrow. And then someone else is like, okay, cool. So that means about 1 million Americans are going to be unemployed. Yeah, yeah. But we need to burn it all to the ground. It's like, okay, cool. How do we do that? I don't know. But we need to do that. We need to just burn it all to the ground in Roblox, you know? It's like, I don't know. Is that going to do anything? But if it's like, well, we need to definitely enact legislation that is going to dramatically curtail both their monopolization in general and stop their endless growth and the way that they are predatory and destroying other companies, because we can approach this very rationally from a security standpoint, that it's going to be counterproductive to the people of the United States. I mean, imagine trying to talk about the exploitation of labor and turn that into a national security issue. Like, if Americans are sick, if Americans can't make ends meet, if Americans are being exploited in every job they work in, if they don't even have ownership in the companies in which they work, it destroys America. It is going to destroy this country from the inside out. That would be a very... I know people are saying, well, those are kind of popular talking points. I understand the security issue being one, but I haven't heard someone try to, I don't know, reframe things in that way. It would be interesting. Tell her about Grizzcom and Left Reckoning. Okay, I will. I will definitely do that. And then maybe they can get her on the Majority Report, because that would be a lot bigger, you know? A lot bigger than me. So you've just been listening to an episode of The Surf Times, and if you enjoy it and want to see The Surf Times, you can go to wearesurfs.com or watch the live shows at thesurfs.tv. And also everywhere social media is sold, basically thesurfs.tv, you'll find us there, twitter.com/thesurfstv, for example. It would also help us out tremendously if you could leave a good review of this podcast if you enjoyed it, either on, I don't know, iTunes or wherever you're podcasting. Apparently it does help, and yeah, we hope to see you soon.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Just, we beseech thee to smite down our enemies. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, we are but your humble court jesters, here to amuse you. To our lords, Trevor R., we give thanks for this spit of land for us to eke out this meager existence. To our knights, Merid, Cheryl Alvarez, Ruby Kelly, Ellie Leslie, Alex P., Brandon, Words Greenwood, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariane McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Coulter Smith, Val 9000, Jenna Tall, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Omni, Riley and Anna, Poodlehawk, The Tim Caucus, Multimondi, Trevor Yanis, Lemmy 101, Anthropophojack, Saren 42, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Nkosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We raise our flag in a veil, and we salute you, our friends.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.